As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello and welcome back to this episode of the Game Football Podcast from The Times. Today, we reflect on the end of the Champions League group stage. We'll ask who are the favourites for the title outright. What's happened to Chelsea over the past few matches as they finish as runners-up in their group? We'll also ask, is this the lowest point for Barcelona? Are Leeds United fatigued by Bielsa ball? And how will new COVID restrictions affect football? All that and more on this episode of The Game. Hello, welcome back to The Game Podcast. I am Hugh Wilsoncroft alongside Tom Clark and Ian Hawkey. We'll also be joined by Rick Broadbent talking Leeds a little bit later on. But we've got to start by looking back on this week in the Champions League, the final group games. And there were a couple of surprises. Let's begin with Chelsea's trip to the homeland of their owner, Roman Abramovich. It finished Zenit St. Petersburg 3, Chelsea 3, but that coupled with Juventus' win over Malmo means Chelsea, the European champions, of course, finish as runners-up in Group H, with Juve instead at the top. The Chelsea manager, Thomas Tuchel, felt his side weren't really themselves after a positive start to the game. What do we think he meant by that, Ian?
They're in a bit of a blip by their high standards, aren't they? And I guess the most obvious symptom is you associate Tuchel's Chelsea with being, you know, really well organized defensively, and they've conceded three goals again. I guess that's the most obvious single flaw that's emerged over the last couple of weeks. There's a sort of sense that at the moment they're not getting both halves of the team right at the same time. They scored three goals in St. Petersburg. Timo Werner looked really good. Maybe the defenders were really surprised to see that and lost their bearings. Yeah, they've certainly fallen off, haven't they? Of the top three, most conspicuously. And Tuchel will clearly be very disappointed at the slack goals they're conceding. They're a little unlucky with one of them against West Ham, but and of course now to be second seed in the draw really does look like a considerable disadvantage.
Tom, no N'Golo Kante, no Mateo Kovacic, no Jorginho for Chelsea. One win in four or three in seven, if you want to look that far back. Do you think their season's faltering?
Stuttering rather than faltering, I'll say. I don't know whether they're any different, but I'm going to pick a slightly different word to you because it feels a little bit less harsh. Yeah, it's a little blip, as Ian said. But in some respects, I don't think it's necessarily a terrible thing because, you know, they're not falling away in the title race. They are through in the Champions League. And as he showed last season in winning the Champions League, I think he can set up teams to do quite well against the bigger sides, teams that people might say when the draw comes around, oh God, that's a difficult draw for Chelsea. I would back Tuchel to set Chelsea up to get through that tie. And I do think watching the game, there were a couple of positives, as Ian hinted at. Timo Werner looked really sharp. His second goal in particular is the kind of goal that he's just not scored for Chelsea the whole time he's been there. It shows what perhaps the first goal, a tap in on the goal line, can do for your confidence. But and in creating Romelu Lukaku's goal as well, he was a big part of that and he looked really sharp. And Lukaku scoring is a good thing as well because he's been out of sorts, as we've discussed on recent podcasts. So yeah, a little bit of a stutter, a little blip, but with those players showing a few bright sparks, I thought Kepa was fantastic, made some great, great saves. And so in terms of being the goalkeepers union, which, you know, I quite like to pretend that I'm part of from time to time on the podcast, with some discussions around Mendy, I think that's no bad thing to have him as a backup if you decided to switch at any point. Not that I'm saying they should at the moment, but yeah, enough positives to not be too worried as a Chelsea fan, I think.
Do you think Kepa should have saved the final goal, the equaliser?
Oh, no.
It was just a question.
I was more disappointed with the lacklustre closing down on the edge of the box. There was a couple of Chelsea players that they looked like they were a team already qualified and just wanted to get the plane home. And I felt a little bit sorry for Kepa in that moment.
Yeah, a little bit of complacency, I think. You are right about that. We mentioned Timo Werner already. Romelu Lukaku also on the score sheet, Ian. Do you see that there's going to be a good chance of them forging a real partnership for Chelsea?
On the evidence of that game, yes. And if you look at their characteristics, logic says, yes, they should. Lukaku last season had a really good partnership with Lautaro Martinez, who I think is probably a better player all round than Timo Werner. But you can see that having somebody quick playing off him, you know, should be good. And Lukaku is a very generous fellow striker. I guess what you then look at is what might be the sacrifices in terms of the other attacking players and what it would take for Tuchel to decide that this is very much definitively a front two or two in a front three that he absolutely, you know, first on the team sheet plus one other. And I think that probably he'd be some way from doing that at this stage.
Chelsea could face Bayern Munich, Real Madrid, Ajax or Lille next. Really? 3 out of 4 chance, maybe a half chance that they get a draw that you'd expect them to comfortably win, Tom?
Do I go for the classic managerial cliche of no such thing as an easy game, Hugh? No, I won't. No, some of those ties are definitely more difficult than others. I actually think in a weird way, Ajax might be the more difficult game for this Chelsea team. A little bit more unpredictable. All the hipsters' favourites, of course, doing very well this season, looking quite bright. And I wonder whether, obviously they wouldn't want Bayern Munich. I wonder whether Ian thinks they'd beat the current Real Madrid team. I think that they probably would. I don't think that fixture comes with as much fear as it used to in the past. I don't know about you, Ian, whether you'd agree that they'd beat Madrid.
They have a recent success to look back on, and it's not a greatly changed Real Madrid team from last season. However, Real Madrid have a very good manager, and they are coming good at the moment. I say it's not a vastly changed team from last season. It isn't in terms of personnel, but what Carlo Ancelotti has done very successfully is bring the best out of several players. Vinicius, above all, he's been outstanding this season. And, you know, if he doesn't go past you, then he's going to win a free kick or a penalty off you. However, overall, you would favour Chelsea against Madrid. I think that's quite a stark look about the Champions League now that there are, you know, three very, very strong Premier League clubs and Bayern Munich. And then I think the gap beneath that looks quite big at the moment. Madrid would probably be at the top along with PSG of the next best, I would say. And
Manchester United. Thanks, Ian. Appreciate it.
Well, Hugh, whenever I big up Manchester United, you contradict me. So I just thought we might reverse roles.
Well, I was only joking about that as well. Yeah. You won't hear any positivity from me about United anytime soon.
I think one thing to bear in mind possibly with Madrid is that the Spanish league at the moment is looking like a one-horse race. So it's very possible that, you know, come February, Ancelotti will be in a position to do a fair amount of rest and rotation ahead of his Champions League tie. It doesn't mean everything, but, you know, it might mean something really surprising like Gareth Bale having a game or Eden Hazard reappearing. They it's not the greatest Madrid side of the last 10 years, but they do have, and Ancelotti has really cultivated quite good strength in depth and some match winners.
Elsewhere, two English sides top their groups. Manchester City were beaten by RB Leipzig in their final group game. Kyle Walker was sent off. Silly from him. They could face Atletico, Sporting, Inter, Benfica, Salzburg, or Atalanta or Villarreal, who play a little bit later on. What's the dream draw, Tom, for City?
Anyone that is not going to make you say that they're going to play three at the back and overthink it and get knocked out, as is your favorite line. I was thinking about City and the Champions League before coming on and wondering whether the title race in the Premier League might play a part, and just how tight that will almost certainly be, at least into the back end of the season, whether they win it or not. And the fact that, as we've talked so often, they haven't quite got a fully settled system. I know that's one of the joys of Pep Guardiola's Manchester City, this you never know what you're going to get, as Alison recently said. But I just wonder whether they could come unstuck in the next round, depending on who they get. I can't quite decide what a dream draw is, because they're in this slightly unsettled, slightly unpredictable mode at the moment. They didn't look great in the match this week. And obviously, Kyle Walker's red card was probably one of the more stupid sendings off I've seen in a long time. So, I mean, I don't know. I think it could be one of those where they don't want the kind of teams that everyone will expect them to beat. That's what they want to avoid. And that maybe, I mean, I keep advocating for English teams to be drawn against the toughest opposition possible, it seems. But I do wonder whether that might actually help City at this stage, just to kind of sharpen their focus, sharpen their attention, and help avoid any kind of slip-ups.
Ian, what do you think about Manchester City? I'm going to ask about Liverpool maybe being favourites in the Champions League in a moment when we discuss them. Do you think Manchester City have a better chance than they did last season?
Yes, I do, because I do think that they have a manager who does absorb lessons, take things on, and they have strengthened the squad with Grealish, and you know, the development of some of their up and coming players continues. So I agree with Tom that there's a sort of built in unpredictableness about City in Europe that when you look at their potential opponents, you can always come up with questions. You know, you could say, oh well, you know, if they get Salzburg, they'll do it in their sleep. But you know, Salzburg are effective at getting behind a defence, which you know used to be a City flaw. So you can always find reasons why City might, in a one-off or a two-legged tie, somehow shoot themselves in the foot when they shouldn't. But I do think they are, you know, they are an improving side in European terms, and I would be very surprised if they don't progress through the next round at least.
Liverpool became the first English team to win 6 games out of 6 in the Champions League group stages. The unrested Mo Salah and Divock Origi scored, but a mainly second string side beat Milan at the San Siro, which is, you know, in terms of names, I guess sends out a message. I would have expected, I think, more from Milan, generally speaking, during this Champions League campaign. They go out, of course. But the question on Liverpool is, are they turning into Champions League favourites, like I mentioned a few moments ago? Tom, what do you think?
Yeah, they're my favourites. There's something about Jurgen Klopp and this competition and his Liverpool side that just seems to fit to me. Even in tough moments, they seem to find a way through. And this season, they've just looked completely in control of all games, depending on, you know, a bit of madness with Atleti here and there, but still they came through. And as you say, this game, Milan aren't the Milan that we've known in the past these days, but still to be putting out the team that Klopp did and win in such a composed manner sent a real message. This competition just suits Klopp and this Liverpool side, I think. We often talk about who the opposition wouldn't want to face. And I think if you were talking about your Bayern Munich's, your Real Madrid's, I think, and I don't know whether you guys would agree with me, Liverpool would be, of all of the English sides, the team that they would want to face the least. I think those sides would rather face Manchester City and Chelsea than Liverpool.
Just one thing in the back of my mind is how efficiently Real Madrid knocked them out last season. Now, I think Liverpool are better, and clearly they've got a tremendous momentum now. I suppose the other imponderable is Mohamed Salah and Sadio Mane. And the African Nations Cup, they'll be obviously back for the next round, but you know, who knows how fatigued they might be, how out of sync they might have become, because you know, this is Klopp's Liverpool are such a momentum, such a mood team. So if Senegal or Egypt were to get to the final of the African Nations Cup, then they only have a couple of weeks before the next round of the Champions League. But, you know, these are details, and I agree with you. I think if you're going to make a favourite at this stage, Liverpool would be it.
I think the English sides are doing pretty well. We're going to talk about Manchester United next. I'm not sure you could call them one of the favourites, but who knows what Ralf Rangnick's going to turn them into over the next couple of months. Up next, we'll discuss his start to life as Manchester United boss. We now have two matches with which to assess Ralf Rangnick's start as Manchester United's interim boss. The 1-0 Premier League win over Crystal Palace and the 1-1 draw with Young Boys in the Champions League. Both games were at Old Trafford. United do go through as group winners. Rangnick already writing history, becoming the first German coach to win his opening Premier League game. Two things for me were immediately noticeable versus Palace. The first, United playing with an extremely high defensive line, almost Brentford-ish, 20 metres inside the opposition half at corners. And the second one was that they were fighting to win the ball in the final third more than we've seen before. They did it 12 times against Palace. Their previous best in the Premier League was 7. Ian, what have you made of Rangnick's so-called revolution?
Yeah, I mean, he's clearly made a good impression, possibly with quite kind fixtures. The timing of his arrival was quite convenient in that sense. But yeah, I mean, you can see his stamp. He did bold things in selection against Young Boys, which I think will please fans to see that he's open-minded and so on. But importantly, against Crystal Palace, yes, there were clearly some fresh instructions, some quite bold instructions, and they were carried out quite efficiently. And he's made all the right noises, hasn't he? He's praised Cristiano Ronaldo, and he's been very media friendly. I mean, clearly there are bigger challenges ahead. I think we will probably inevitably see signs of a manager coming in mid season, which is always awkward, and aspects of the Premier League which possibly surprise him, take him aback. But yeah, so far so good.
What sort of things do you expect to take him back?
Well, I think he was going to be confronted probably quite starkly by the tempo and certainly the way that affects teams over this period. You know, lots of fixtures all bumping into one another. I mean, he's got a deep squad to deal with that, but you know, that's always a difficult thing for managers from other European leagues to get used to, you know, the lack of a significant winter pause and the all-weather brutality of the Christmas period.
Fred looked very confident, trying his little awkward passes he does that no one sees coming. Could he have a huge role under Rangnick?
He will, until Manchester United finally sign a defensive midfielder of the kind of caliber that they need. Because he's a trier, as you say. When things are going well for Manchester United, Fred is often highlighted as, oh, isn't he good? He puts himself about the pitch. And then when they're going bad, it's Fred isn't good enough. I mean, I also think Worldy's a bit strong. It was a good finish, wasn't it, for the lad? But
on his right leg. It's only for balance.
I know he's left footed, but I think Worldy's a bit strong. Look, in some respects, he embodies the current Manchester United a little bit, because he tries hard, but ultimately he's a bit 7 out of 10, and that's really where Man United are at the minute. I think just touching more on Rangnick and those two games, one thing that is interesting to me, and we talked a lot with Constantine about his tactics and how he likes to play, and he said, didn't he, after watching the Arsenal game from the stands, that I know you all enjoyed it, you English football fans, but that's not that kind of football I want. I want control. And yes, he made a lot of changes against Young Boys, and yes, there were lots of academy players in there, but that lack of control was still there. And I've not seen Manchester United control a game in the way that Rangnick's talking about, in terms of stopping the opposition and looking like you're going to score in that very efficient and effective way. I've not seen Manchester United play like that for a long time. And I think that is what will take a bit of a time for him to implement. It's positive signs. I think, as Ian said, it's quite smart of him to play a few academy players. Manchester United, so synonymous with youth and academy players, that it's a smart move politically to give players their debuts to blood some youngsters in a game that didn't matter. I don't know whether Fred is the answer. I don't know whether he's the problem, but I don't see him having a massively key role at Manchester United long term, no.
We'll clip that one up. We'll use that one at the end of the season when he wins Manchester United Player of the Year.
Well, look, if he does win Player of the Year, that'll probably sum up Manchester United's season, because they will get knocked out of the Champions League in the next round. They won't win any trophies and they'll finish fifth.
Whoa. Take it easy here. Manchester United's problem has been that they've been poorly coached. Ralf Rangnick is there to solve all of those issues. There's talent in the team. They could have an incredible year.
I agree. But when you reflect on the things we talked about with Constantine on a previous show, and some of the things you talked about there, a bit more pressing, Rangnick liking his teams to win the ball high up the pitch, because it's all about trying to then turn that opportunity into a chance to score a goal. Those things take time. We know they take time to implement. Pep Guardiola, Jurgen Klopp, they're fantastic. They're legendary. They both took at least a season, was it? Maybe even more, to fully get Liverpool and Manchester City playing the way they want to play. And also, you've got to factor in that Rangnick's an interim coach. So he's operating in this mode of, am I going to be in charge in the summer? Am I going to have a role as this kind of consultant? I'm not sure. So he is undoubtedly an intelligent and impressive coach who's done great things in the game. But I just don't see it, as I said a few weeks ago, I don't see it being one of those immediate managerial bounces. I think it'll be a while before we see the Ralf Rangnick imprint on this Manchester United squad.
I thought he did amazingly well in his second game against Young Boys. To start with a team like he did and not lose a game in the Champions League is remarkable. Donny van de Beek and Juan Mata as your two holding midfielders. I mean, this was Fergie-esque, wasn't it? This was unbelievable. Mata started, van de Beek, as I said, but Greenwood was in, Elanga was in, Amad Diallo was in. Six players made their debuts, Ian. This, for me, was a challenge to the group that he has. That it's a clean slate for everyone, that he's open to use everyone. Do you think the players are going to respond to that? Maybe the players that weren't involved against Young Boys are going to respond to that?
To a degree, yes. I think, there was a, I wouldn't say crowd pleasing, because that sounds frivolous. You know, there was a sort of broadly political aspect to blooding these players for the benefit of those players and, you know, given the stakes in the game. I'd be surprised if many established first teamers are that's worried about a previously barely known teenager taking their place. I think, you know, there is competition for places in parts of the United team, less in midfield perhaps, but I would be very surprised to see Juan Mata replacing Fred, for instance, as a holding midfielder.
Manchester United won the group. Does anyone think they're getting to the quarterfinals? We haven't seen the draw yet. Blind draw. Do you see them going through, Tom?
No, I don't. A lot will rely on Cristiano Ronaldo and whether he comes up with those moments that he did through the group stage, because let's be honest, without some of those, you know, Rangnick wouldn't have been playing the kids last night against Young Boys, and Man United would have desperately needed a win. So a lot will depend on that. I don't know. I'm being a bit grumpy and downbeat about Manchester United on the podcast today and a bit about Ralf Rangnick. So I'm going to continue, and I'm not doing it to wind you up. I think they might struggle in the next round.
Atletico's there, Sporting's there, Salzburg's there. Fingers crossed for this draw on Monday morning, by the way.
You sound very hopeful, Hugh. Is it just being rid of Solskjaer, or is it Rangnick? Is it the choice of coach and what you've heard that as a Manchester United fan makes you enthused?
No. I wouldn't base it on what I've heard. On what I've seen, there's clearly a plan. It's obviously the very early stages of that, but there is clearly a plan. The plan that Manchester United have does work for some teams. The issue is it doesn't work for all players, and I don't think it's going to work for all the players in Manchester United's team. I worry for Harry Maguire defending 15 metres inside the opposition half, for example. Yeah. But it's clear there's a plan to condense the pitch as much as possible, to win the ball back very, very high. And Manchester United's forward players, whether we like it or not, there's quality there. For me, it's a plan that could work for Manchester United, which is why I'm positive. And already, I think a few of the players are just playing with a little bit more confidence. I don't know if Ole Gunnar Solskjaer was holding them back. I don't like blaming the coach for that, because I think you've got to give everything when you go over the white line. And I don't think, for me, at that level, you play for Manchester United, the manager should be, you know, getting you to go out there and just try your absolute hardest. I know confidence is something that's not easy, but I think the players at Manchester United, as Cristiano Ronaldo shows, you know, you don't have to play well as a team to play well as an individual. And I think there was enough individual talent there to have got Ollie some more results. But there you go. We are where we are. I'll take it, because I think Ralf Rangnick could be a success. But I wonder whether Xavi is going to be a success at Barcelona. That huge story in the Champions League, Barcelona's exit. They didn't get past the group stage for the first time in 21 years. They were swept aside 3-0 by Bayern Munich, and they only scored twice in their six group games. Xavi said, "This is the Champions League, but this is also our reality. It's the situation we're in. I'm angry. This is the reality, and it pisses me off. We have to tackle it face on. There's nothing else for it. A new era starts today. We start from zero. Our objective is the Champions League, not the Europa League," which is where they are. "But that's our reality now, and we have to try and win it." Seventh in La Liga as well, Ian. I'm not sure he can turn it around. Nothing to do with him as a coach, but the materials he's going to be working with over the next few seasons might not be at the level that he's aiming for. Do you think he can turn it around?
It depends a lot on the patience that's shown to him. The choice of Xavi as head coach comes with a certain degree of patience, because obviously club legend, etc. They've been through too many coaches in the last 2 years. So, you know, as long as he doesn't become so exasperated that he walks, then I think he will have a degree of patience from those above him. Your point about the players he's got to work with, yeah, clearly at the moment it's insufficient. I mean, the last Barca that Xavi played in had Messi, Neymar, and Luis Suarez at his peak up front. At the moment, he's waiting for Martin Brathwaite to see if he can be fit again. That's a pretty stark contrast. And you know, and asking Luke de Jong if he can perhaps stray outside the penalty area occasionally. You know, it's a pretty harsh decline. However, there are a group of young players who, teenagers actually, around whom you can imagine a fruitful future as long as they stay. Pedri, Gavi, Ansu Fati, if he can be fit. So, you know, I think Xavi will have the idea that he can cultivate this group so that in 2 or 3 years' time, they are calling themselves, you know, light heavyweights, at least in Europe again. The difficulty is the tone as well. I mean, all this stuff about that's our reality, this is being echoed quite a lot. And it was something that Ronald Koeman said quite a lot. And it does begin to sound like a terrible, dreary fatalism. I think Xavi knows that is not the mood that you want to create. But at the same time, he needs to make it clear that, well, I suppose brutally, this isn't my fault. This is our circumstances. And that, you know, you're going to have to bear with me on this. But, you know, he will be very diligent. He will be very thoughtful. He will be quite Guardiola-like. But it may be that, you know, he's got to deal with 2, maybe 3 years of Europa League football in order to start climbing back to where they used to be.
Ian, I was thinking about Barcelona this morning, and I wondered whether, and maybe this is too lazy of me, but we're obviously just riffing off Manchester United then. Is the Barcelona situation similar to United in the sense that there's money to spend, it's just been spent badly and bad decisions have been made and there's a need for structure? Or is it a little bit more similar to Arsenal, say, where there's a little bit less money than they're used to, and again, managers haven't been given time to rebuild from not the bottom up, but to get a bit higher? I just wondered whether either of those were more similar, just to kind of give listeners an idea of where they're at for such a big club in a difficult situation. Are they more Arsenal or are they more Manchester United?
More Arsenal, quite clearly. I think that's a very good question. far more Arsenal, in the sense that there are big debts to service. And while Barcelona have income streams to compare with Manchester United, they have a lot more constraints on how much they can spend immediately for various reasons, partly to do with La Liga, partly to do with post-COVID. Their ability to sign superstar players now, I think, has overnight diminished slightly. You know, there is that thing. Barcelona is the kind of club that a lot of footballers grow up wanting to join. But Europa League, seventh place in La Liga, Barcelona, with less extravagant wages than they used to have, that's a different prospect when you're going out to recruit. So yeah, I mean, absolutely, Tom. Far more Arsenal at the moment than Manchester United.
Well, we'll see if Barcelona can get anywhere near their best over the next few seasons, but I think it's going to be a long road back for Xavi as their manager. That's our conversation all wrapped up on the European football and the Champions League, of course. We'll be talking Leeds United next before we discuss how Omicron and new infections of COVID-19 could affect football over the coming weeks. But remember, if you're enjoying the podcast, like us, rate us, and of course, make sure you're subscribed.
The train is now approaching. Junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, road station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Leeds United sit 15th in the Premier League after their draw with Brentford last time out. Marcelo Bielsa's side have only managed 3 wins this season in the league. They sit 6 points above the relegation zone after 15 games. Now, remember, they finished 9th in their first season back in the Premier League last year after a 16-year break. Let's speak to the Times' Rick Broadbent, who I imagine I can describe as a long-suffering Leeds fan as well. Rick, what do you think the main issue has been for Leeds United this season?
If we spoke to fans, they'd immediately just go to the default, oh, half the team's been injured, which to an extent is true, but I think it goes much deeper. I don't think it's Bielsa burnout in the sense that they're physically done, but I think mentally they look a bit shot, to be honest. You know, they're not making decisions like they were last season. They're not getting at teams like they did last season. The identity that, you know, annoyed some people because people, you know, Gary Neville was always going on about how brilliant Leeds were when they were 3-0 down at half time. But there was a certain joy to watching them play last season, mostly, and that's just gone. So I think it's really deep. Some of it is down to having such a tiny squad, which is Bielsa's way, but that's been sort of found wanting. So when, you know, Bamford's been out for a long time and they haven't really got anybody who can replace him. Same when Calvin Phillips is out injured, which he is again now. It's looking grim, to be honest. The weary optimism of Leeds supporters, I think, is probably plateauing, to say the least.
What sort of reaction are you expecting from the players, from the management team? Are you, you know, Marcelo Bielsa is seen as a footballing legend. What are you hoping he does in the coming weeks to arrest the situation? Or do you expect maybe in January the club to do something there?
I think, first of all, he is a legend. I mean, you've got to remember this is a club that was useless for 15 years, 14 years before he pitched up. You know, we were picking managers on pub recommendations, people like Dave Hockaday, and we actually had an owner who failed the fit and proper test, which is almost impossible to do. You know, this club was shocking, really. So he is a legend in Leeds terms, but they've got to do something. I mean, the easy thing is say, oh, they need to buy some players, and they do need a bigger squad. I mean, they've just I mean, they brought in Junior Firpo from Barcelona, who looks like he's barely played football for, well, maybe ever. I mean, he looks shocking. And they're relying so much on Rafinha. You know, without him, they'd already be in the bottom three. Because those three wins that you mentioned, I mean, they're all by a single goal. The Norwich one needed Tim Krul to sort of jump over a ball. Watford, there was a disallowed goal by Watford, which, you know, helped. Palace, 85th minute penalty. I mean, they've been squeaking points. It's hard to think what they can do. I mean, they looked really good in the first half against Spurs. That looked a bit more like the old Leeds, albeit, you know, Spurs weren't great at that time. I mean, they're getting better now. But I don't know. I mean, they're going to have to buy someone because Phillips is out for a long time by the looks of it. And they haven't got anybody who can fit in there. But they just need to get back to sort of what they were doing last season, which was a bit gung-ho, going for teams and playing with a bit of joy. I mean, there's not much joy in that team at the moment. So it's really hard. But if they are sort of jaded mentally, which possibly are, then I don't know how you get that back.
Tom, what do you think about Leeds right now? What sort of situation are they in for you? Do you think they'll get out of it, particularly at the bottom of the table?
It's a really strange one because from the outside, there's still, Rick mentioned it there, that kind of Gary Neville slight laziness about them in that, oh, it's Marcelo Bielsa, it's Leeds, we all love them, they're fantastic. But they have struggled this season. And I think Rick's point about them being mentally shot is the most interesting to me because that does seem the case. They do seem a little bit lacking in ideas. But one thing I was wondering was I was just looking at the fixture list and it's pretty scary stuff that they've got coming up. They've got Chelsea, Man City, Arsenal, Liverpool, and then Steven Gerrard's resurgent Aston Villa as the next five games to end the year, which is pretty, pretty stark. But one thing I was wondering, Rick, was do you think that playing against these bigger teams, these tougher teams, might help Bielsa and the players maybe reset the system, the formation, the tactics, and take a bit of the pressure off? Because they're obviously games that you'll go into where the fans and the pundits won't be expecting you to get anything. And maybe that might help a Bielsa team maybe spring a surprise because the pressure's off a bit. You're not dominating possession. You can kind of go back to some of those basics of pressing, trying to win the ball. Do you think that might help in a strange way, the tough fixtures they've got to come?
I mean, it might do. I mean, these sort of fixture lists rarely sort of pan out as you expect, don't they? I mean, bear in mind, they did beat Man City away with 10 men last year. So, you know, I don't think that one will hold too many fears for them. But it's just that they don't look like that side of last season that you would think, yeah, they will create chances. And so they've got a chance if they, you know, don't let in three at the other end. This season, they're just not. It's funny because I was looking at the stats and apparently they're eighth in expected goals in the Premier League, fourth in possession. You think, well, those are not stats of a team that's going down. But then I don't know who's expecting these goals to go in because, I don't know, maybe they haven't seen Leeds shooting because they're not the greatest. But I don't know if the bigger teams is going to help. Playing against the bigger teams is going to help. They've barely scored more than a goal in a game this season. And it's hard to think that they're going to stop those sides, the Liverpool, Man City, Chelsea, from scoring at least one. So it's hard to see where they're going to get a win from, especially if Bamford is out. I mean, it sounds like Bamford might be out again, tweaking his hamstring, having come back from his hamstring. So it's tricky. I mean, I think the fixture list evens itself out over the course of the season, obviously, but they need something. I mean, they've got Dan James in, there's a lot of high expectations. I mean, he hasn't really sort of done too much so far. Stuart Dallas was brilliant last season. I mean, he's played largely at fullback this season, so hasn't really influenced much and just hasn't been on form. Luke Ayling, I think, is a huge miss. I mean, he's back, which is a good thing because he's a bit of a, apart from being a good player, he seems to be a sort of almost spiritual sort of leader. I mean, he does sort of get forward and, yeah, I mean, it'd be great to see him rip off his hairband and sort of celebrate a goal or something. But I don't know, it's tricky.
Are you down about Leeds at the moment?
I mean, you know, I've followed them long enough to not expect too much. But I think just because of last season, I mean, I just totally enjoyed last season so much. And it wasn't even the results, although they helped. But it's just, you watched them and thought, this is going to be fun. You know, they might get turned over, but it's going to be fun and they're going to have a go. And it's not been like that this season. And once you get into a rut, you know, it can be quite hard to get out of. I don't think they'll go down. I think they've got enough to stay up. And I think there's enough dross around to sort of be the high end of the dross sort of league. But it is surprising. I mean, you thought they might, I thought they'd struggle a bit more than last season, but not to this extent.
I do want to ask you about the future of Leeds United. I don't know if you've seen the stories, but in the NFL, the San Francisco 49ers, storied franchise, and they have an investment arm with an option to own 100% of Leeds United and Elland Road by January of 2024, it's been reported. 49ers Enterprises increased their stake in Leeds to 44% in November. The deal to take total ownership could be worth in excess of £500 million. Now, Chairman Andrea Radrizzani remains the majority shareholder. His company, Acer, has the option to void the deal, but it has been widely expected, I've been reading, that there will be a takeover that happens before 2024, Rick. What do you think the future of Leeds is? Will they have new owners soon?
The honest answer is I don't know if that will happen. I mean, I do know that, you know, everybody's firmly in Radrizzani's corner, you know, given what he's done for this club and given the owners they've had in the past from Ken Bates through to Salino. Yeah, they certainly would support anything he does. If that means selling to San Francisco, then you sort of think on paper that can only be a good thing. But, you know, sometimes these owners, I mean, the Radrizzani seems to have the heart of the club, albeit, you know, he seems to understand the place. But yeah, I mean, they could do with more money. They could do with a new stadium for a start. I mean, they've got one big stand and three sort of grotty sort of relics from the 1970s. So they could do with that. But I think the thing that Leeds fans are more worried about than that is Bielsa. You know, he's very deep into this project. I mean, he doesn't usually stay around this long, which might be why we're having this sort of effect on the pitch now, because it's sort of unproven how his methods work at this stage. You know, whether they can go, this players can buy into it for this long. Digressing slightly, but that PowerPoint presentation he did after Spygate and Derby and when Frank Lampard's head was exploding, you know, that 80-minute PowerPoint presentation. Imagine what it's like for a player sort of facing this on a weekly basis. I mean, it's got to sort of be quite exacting. So what's going to happen to Bielsa? Presumably he's going to go at some point, whether it's next season, the season after. I mean, he's not going to be here for too long. And then obviously you're going to lose Rafinha. I mean, I think that's a given almost, that at some point he's going to want to go on. So you just wonder where it will go, even if they stay up. But if they go down, you could see it all splintering quite quickly. And, you know, I don't imagine the 49ers would want a championship club. Because of the way Bielsa operates, signing one-year contracts sort of the day before the season starts, people have started to live a bit sort of day by day and not really think too much about the long term. But the whole 49ers thing, I think, is, you know, it just sounds quite sexy, doesn't it? I think that people would go along with it.
Rick Broadbent, thank you for joining us on the Game Podcast. Plenty more to come, as well as we look ahead to a big game at Anfield this weekend. The new variant Omicron of COVID-19 is spreading quickly, and that has meant some new restrictions announced yesterday by the government in the United Kingdom. The NHS COVID pass is going to be required for venues of more than 500 people indoors, unseated outdoor venues with more than 4,000 people, and any event with more than 10,000 people. So that could be a direct effect on football. But there have been outbreaks at a couple of Premier League clubs, Spurs and Leicester, already, who should have important Europa League games tonight. Tottenham's game against Rennes has been officially postponed by UEFA. Leicester meant to be taking on Napoli. It's reported that seven of their players have been struck down by COVID-19, which I think bears the question, what will happen to football if this continues over the coming weeks? Now, of course, we will know more about exactly, I guess, the exact effects of this new Omicron variant in the next sort of 10 days as new data comes in. I guess that will define what happens in terms of us being able to go to football matches, or even if football matches will continue. Without knowing that, it's very difficult to answer this, except to say at this point in time, as we're in the unknown, Tom, should fans still be going to football matches?
Oof, I think that's incredibly difficult. I think I would say if other events such as theatre, music, concerts and all that kind of thing are ongoing, football fans should not be excluded, particularly because when you think back to some of the decisions that have been made as we've dealt with coronavirus, often sport fans and football fans were hit hardest, in that we were made to wait the longest, I think, in some of the waves and some of the lockdowns to come out of them to go back to ground. So, you know, we are in this period now with passports and people being double vaccinated, where the belief is that that gives you a bit of protection. So I think if that's the wider view, that other events can carry on, I don't see the need for football to be hit in any other way. You only need to look at Manchester City's game in the Champions League without any fans. I mean, I was watching bits of that and I thought, no, let's not go back to this. I was like having horrible, horrible flashbacks to it being winter and being watching a football match with no fans. It wasn't fun. Obviously, serious health concerns can get in the way. But yeah, I would say for now, I think a bit of caution is good, but I don't think we should be looking at a blanket ban on fans going to games just yet.
There is going to be an issue with rescheduling matches, though, Ian. For example, Spurs against Rennes, there is a December the 31st cutoff point. Now, UEFA might relax that, I don't know, but Rennes go on their winter break on the 22nd of December, and we know how busy the Christmas period is for teams in the Premier League. So what happens now?
This is complicated. I think UEFA won't be inclined to be absolutely stringent about that if there is no alternative. But yeah, it's hard to see how it can slot in, and it's already complicated from a sporting integrity point of view, because the simultaneous match involving Vitesse Arnhem and Moussa does have a slight bearing on what Spurs need to do in their match against Rennes. So, you know, already it's clearly very imperfect, which doesn't matter in the overall public health picture. It's an ominous indication of what might happen if more matches have to be postponed. And, you know, the calendar, as we know, is not suited to a great traffic of postponements. It's so tight anyway. It's so tight partly because of what happened with the last outbreak. And yeah, it will be mind-bogglingly complicated for administrators if there's much more of this.
What do you think then, Tom? Do you think UEFA will relax it? And if we see, here's the big question, I think, for me. If we see a raft of games having to be postponed, what happens further down the line with the league? Do we start to forfeit matches at any point in time? We've been through this before. Or do we keep, you know, knocking games back and back and back and then worry about that as we get to the final sort of 6 weeks?
I think the latter guess of yours is probably the right one. We have to remember money talks, doesn't it? With all these competitions, all the sponsors, all the television deals, all that comes into play when it comes to thinking about forfeiting matches. In fact, sadly, those factors probably are at the forefront of clubs' minds as much as when it comes to the points and the competition. So I don't see forfeits becoming a reality if there are situations such as Tottenham's. There will be some sort of leniency further down the line in terms of when these matches can be played. Potentially the Premier League will take a hit and we'll see a big raft of madness in April and late March with fixtures coming thick and fast. And maybe we'll be back to the days of a Premier League match every single night of the week. Who knows? It's same with fans not going to grounds. I don't see forfeits and matches not happening at some point as a reality just yet.
We look like we could be in a similar situation. Fingers crossed we are not. We have some good news over Omicron in the next couple of weeks. Ian Hawkey, Tom Clark, thank you for being with me for the past hour or so, and to Rick Broadbent as well, and to all of you for listening. Remember, we will be back on Monday just before the Champions League draw, so that's going to be slightly awkward for us. We'll see what we can do with that. Otherwise, make sure you're subscribed to The Times and the Sunday Times for more of our award-winning journalism. In the meantime, of course, we'll react to Steven Gerrard's homecoming, if you like, as Aston Villa boss going back to Liverpool at the weekend. So just go online, check it out. If you sign up today, you'll get yourself 1 month free. It's thetimes.co.uk/thegame. We will see you on Monday.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.